Diplomacy was criminalized. This hoax criminalized diplomacy.
Welcome to the show that the fact checkers warned you about. The one that debunks the mainstream narrative and gives you high signal, actionable content that helps you navigate the clown world. It's Bomb Thrower TV with your host, Mark Jeftovic.
Hey everybody, Mark Jeftovic here with another edition of Bomb Thrower TV. Very happy to have a guest on today who I've known for a long time and has a timely appearance because he's got a book coming out next week, or possibly by the time you hear this. It's Hans Mahnke, the author of Swift Boating America, Exposing the Russiagate Fraud from the Steele Dossier to the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane Investigation. So Hans, it's nice to connect with you here on the show. And let's start with, you know, a bit of your background. Who are you and how did you come to be writing this book?
Yeah, those are really good questions, especially the last one there. So, well, thanks, first of all, for having me on your show. I'm just a humble lawyer and academic. And so for most of my adult life, I've just done legal work, taught in various universities, just done the run-of-the-mill stuff, wasn't involved with any of this Russiagate stuff, not involved with any politics, not involved with any journalism, wasn't even on Twitter. I mean, just none of the above. And I kind of got interested in this whole story, the Russiagate story, in around 2017, because there were a couple of things happening back then, and I described those in the book, kind of the early Mueller investigation when they were trying to get Trump on these various charges and so on. And the whole thing was sort of building into something, much bigger, which was clearly to try and get rid of Trump. And, again, I wasn't particularly following any of these details or whatever. I knew why they wanted to get rid of him. But it just occurred to me, I just stumbled upon some of these legal documents coming out of the Mueller thing, and it was just false. I mean, what they were saying was just false. It was just demonstrably false. And then, of course, I thought, well, okay, I'm a lawyer. This is legal stuff. Why would they say false stuff? And why would some of Trump's people agree with the false stuff? And, you know, what's going on here? And that was kind of my gateway into all of this. And in terms of how this ended up being a book, I guess I spent so many years on this, especially on Twitter, with other people who I met online, you know, people from the US, from Canada, from Holland, just all over the place, who were all interested in the same topic and who were all kind of trying to figure out this puzzle in real time as we went along. And I just wanted to kind of capture that story just in a book so that people, you know, long after we're all dead, first of all, know the truth about Russiagate, like what actually happened. And I've got more than 600 footnotes in there specifically for someone one day to go back and look at the original primary source documents. So everything in the book is just the way it happened. And second of all, I also wanted to capture the contributions made by, you know, all these random Twitter people in solving this mystery.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, would you call yourself like a MAGA guy or a Trumper before all this started? Or were you just from a legal point of view, you just couldn't square in your mind like what the contradiction and what you were seeing and what was being put forth as like legally true stuff?
Yeah, that was certainly my entry into this. Now, I was happy when Trump ran, and I think I realized really from the very first moment that this is what's needed, someone to shake up the system. But it wasn't so much about Trump. It wasn't so much about MAGA. It wasn't about any of those things. It was just a kind of a long-held belief that the system needs some shaking up. And that's what I thought was great. But that was sort of the end of, or the extent of my interest in the matter. That, and of course, when he won, I was happy because I thought, whoa, cool, now we're going to have the shakeup, which then did not turn out because he kept being hobbled. And part of what the book is about and part of what Russiagate is about is the fact that he was hobbled and that the deep state, you know, for lack of a better word, just hobbled him at every single turn. So that in itself then, you know, increased my interest. But, you know, coming back to your question, no, you know, I was just, I wasn't particularly interested in any of these things. So it just sort of, it grew on me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And where does the swift boating moniker come from?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this entire Russiagate hoax was created by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Now, it's been known for, you know, with there's been various terms for it, you know, Spygate, Russiagate, you know, many other terms over the years. But I kind of wanted to get to the core of it. When did this all start? Now, maybe in 2015, someone in the Hillary campaign had this idea of tying Trump to Russia, falsely tying him to Russia. We don't know what we don't know, but we do have documentary proof in the form of some emails that were released by WikiLeaks 8 years ago, where they call this Trump-Russia project the Swift Boat Project. That's what the Hillary campaign calls it. So her campaign communications chief emails with this other guy, and they're talking about the Swift Boat Project. So that's where the name comes from, because they tried to Swift Boat Trump. And actually, what they really did is Swift Boat America. Hence, that's where the name comes from. Now, of course, Swift boating itself, that term comes from 2004, where people kind of loosely affiliated with the George W. Bush campaign swift boated John Kerry.
There was a John Kerry reference in there somewhere. I'm like,
but it's that's kind of where the parallels end, because so John Kerry was a swift boat captain or commander or whatever you want to call it back in Vietnam. And swift boats are these like nimble small boats that can go up these estuaries and so on. And he was actually a commander. That's proven. He was actually there. He was actually shot at. He actually saved some guy's life. I mean, this is all documented. So the swift boating of John Kerry in 2004 was about kind of nitpicking what exactly he had done in Vietnam, and was he really a hero or wasn't he? And, you know, just that kind of stuff. And of course, after he came back, he was a anti-war protester. So it was kind of about that sort of thing. But at his core, it was true. He was there. He was shot at. You know, he served. So the swift boating was really kind of on the edges. Whereas this one, the 2016 one, the Hillary one, there's nothing to it. There are no Trump-Russia ties. There's just nothing. I mean, this is something that it took me a long while to really grasp that. And I think many people have not fully grasped it yet, that normally there's, in any kind of hoax, in any kind of situation like this, there's always some little bit of truth somewhere. And then it just kind of gets blown out of all proportions. And that goes for, you know, most of these things. Not this one. In this one, literally the entire thing was made up by the Hillary campaign. There's just no shred of truth to it whatsoever. All made up.
Yeah, I remember when the Mueller investigation findings were released, and it was, you know, so much anticipation had been built on that. Like, this is the end of Trump, and people were saying he was going to get perp walked out of the White House and led straight to prison. There was this huge expectation, and it was such a nothing burger when it came out, and there was just such disappointment. But to this day, after that, and after what we'll talk about with what went on with Russiagate, it's still part of the cultural zeitgeist. Like, you would almost get community noted on Twitter if you actually said something that goes against the Russiagate narrative.
It is. And I have a theory, which is sort of part of the book, but kind of a more epilogue part. I mean, the core of the book is simply to tell the Russiagate story in terms of what actually happened. What did the Hillary people do? What did the FBI do? Down to all its last little details. And it's told from the perspective of the random Twitter users who solved this puzzle. So that's the core of the book. But, you know, towards the back in the epilogue, I kind of start thinking about this. Well, what have they done, these people? Is it just that they hobbled Trump? And in fact, it's much worse than that. It went much further than that. And that's why you're so right about the zeitgeist, that What they did is they basically criminalized diplomacy with Russia. That's what they did with essentially, you know, anything that Trump did to do with Russia. Immediately, there was an outcry. Remember that story when the ambassador came to visit the White House, which is a completely everyday occurrence. Yeah, ambassadors come all the time.
And that's their job.
Completely lost it. And this was like 4 years of that. So how could Trump have gone to Russia or even met Putin? Well, he tried to meet Putin, and that was a disaster as well, again, because of the media. So what's the end result of that? Well, in my view, the end result of that is that Trump was never able to resolve problems like the Ukraine war, which people forget was already going on back then. It didn't start in 2022, it started in 2014. Trump was never able to repair relations with Russia. I mean, repair is too strong a word. I mean, just try and get them somewhat better than where Obama had left them. None of that was possible because of this hoax.
Right. So let's get a high level outline, and we can then sort of dig down, you know, Russiagate, Steele dossier, and then FBI's crossfire, which I actually hadn't even heard of that one until I started reading the book.
Sure. Where do you want to start?
So Russiagate, I guess that's the umbrella for all of this, right?
Right.
So yeah. I guess the Steele dossier then.
Yeah. So the earliest evidence we have, again, documentary evidence of this hoax being planned and perpetrated by the Hillary campaign, was from February of 2016. So they have this exchange of emails. They call it their Swift Boat Project. Shortly after, they go and try and find operatives who can implement this plan. The plan being to just basically tie Trump to the Kremlin, to Putin. That's the idea. And so they hire, they have a law firm, which is called Perkins Coie. And there's a lawyer there called Mark Elias. He's since left, but he was sort of the Hillary Clinton campaign lawyer at the time. He then hired a company called Fusion GPS. Now, I know this sounds kind of convoluted or complicated, but it's important to say that there were different levels of people being hired. And it was Fusion GPS that hired this guy, Christopher Steele. And he, in turn, hired another guy called Igor Danchenko. So you've got four or five layers here. And that's important because it creates deniability. So if Steele or Danchenko says something, well, all the guys above those two guys will say, whoa, we didn't know anything about this. That was just Steele. Or in Steele's case, he could say, well, the dossier isn't really my fault. In fact, that is what he said many years later. It's this guy Danchenko who gave me all this information. So that's how it was set up. Now, what was the information? Well, the information was fed to the by Steele to the Clinton campaign via the Steele dossier, but it was made to order. It wasn't Steele coming up with stories. Steele was told what stories to write. And there's proof of that. Again, that's explained in the book. So Steele was told, you got to tie Trump to Russia. So he comes out with these various dossiers. And as we go along, June of 2016, July, August, each time there's a new dossier report, it's tailored to one or another angle or aspect of what the Clinton campaign wanted. So for instance, in July of 2016, WikiLeaks released some emails from the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. The emails weren't particularly incriminating, had nothing to do with Trump. They were basically about Bernie Sanders. But Hillary wanted to tie Trump to the release by WikiLeaks. So they ordered a dossier report from Steele that basically said this was done by Russia in order to help Trump, and Trump knew about it. And there was a Trump associate that they pulled in who had nothing to do with it, but they just said he was the intermediary. He did all this. He made it all happen. So as you go along, I mean, I'm not going to tell this story for every dossier report. I mean, that's in the book. But, you know, as you go along, each dossier report was tailored to some specific demand. So again, when the WikiLeaks came out, the demand was, well, we need to make Russia responsible for this and tie this to Trump. And so it went every single time. And in the end, you had this Steele dossier, which is basically a compilation of all these individual reports. And you know, the reports are just a few pages long, but the whole thing is about 35, 36 pages.
Just brief aside, but what you're talking about reminds me of, like, over the years, at some point, I stopped doing media interviews about technology because in the early days, it would honestly be a reporter coming in saying, okay, you're the tech expert. Tell me what this means. How does this work? How do I understand this? And then they would walk away and use little bits of the interview. And then somewhere along the line, it changed. And this happened over and over again, where they would come in and say, we're doing a story about X. This is what we think is happening. And we need you to say something that backs this up so that you can be the expert that is underpinning our story. Like the example was, there's a reporter once for the Canadian show, I think it was 16 by 9, if you remember them. He's like, we're tracing one of those fake Google ad scams on television. And I think I have traced this back to this data center in the States. And I want you to say, this data center is behind these Google scams. And I looked at what he said and I said, this is not conclusive. Does any of this sound familiar? I said, this is not a conclusion. This doesn't say anything. This doesn't prove anything. And he's like, well, yeah, but can you say that it does? No, I can't. So then this whole interview, I wasted my whole afternoon, was like him trying to get me to say the thing. And I just wouldn't say the thing. And then a few days later or a week later, he emailed me and he said, oh, we lost the footage. Can we do it over again? And I'm like, no, because it's a complete waste of time. And then a couple other things happened since then. And I just thought, the media has shifted. I mean, I know this, what we were talking about wasn't specifically media in yet, because then it gets disseminated to the media. But it changed from investigating what is happening, what the truth is, to here's our predetermined conclusion, and we need talking heads and intelligence and dossiers to back this up. How many Steele dossiers were there in total?
That's not entirely clear. The number is around 12 to 15. So there are some dossiers, dossier reports, which were never published. And we only know about them indirectly from trying to kind of unredact and figure out what's in these FBI documents. You know, you always get these FBI documents through FOIA, through Freedom of Information, and they were a bunch of releases sort of over the years. And each of them holds these little tiny clues. And, you know, part of the book is explaining how these, you know, random internet users kind of deciphered all this stuff. So one of the parts of deciphering was to try and figure out, well, what else is there? Because, there were actually more reports than the ones that we're familiar with.
Yeah, imagine what some of those ones that never came out. I wonder what those things had in them. if the ones that came out weren't unhinged enough. The DNC emails, I mean, let's talk a bit about how CrowdStrike came into that one. Right. And did you mention it in the book? Because you were talking about internet investigators, there is the forensicator, right, who sort of put out his report refuting what CrowdStrike was saying.
Yeah, I talk about that in the book. I mean, not in huge detail. I mean, that would kind of probably be your task here from a IT point of view. So I try and explain it more from just a common person sort of point of view, where it's sort of still understandable what actually happened there. The short of it is that that there was a problem at the DNC with their emails, and they thought they were being hacked, or it wasn't quite clear what was going on. So they called in CrowdStrike to kind of take a look. While CrowdStrike was taking a look, emails were being exfiltrated, like right under their noses. This is the funniest part. You know, it happened after they came in. Now, some people online have, you know, made a big conspiracy theory out of that. I didn't find any evidence for that. I think they were just incompetent. And they were certainly blasé about it. I mean, they were making jokes at the time. We're talking about, you know, first part of 2016, like, well, if the Russians are in here, they might actually learn something about democracy. So, you know, let them have a look, that kind of, you know, attitude. The weird thing is that once these emails were exfiltrated in June of 2016, immediately the Washington Post ran a story that said Russia did it. And it just seemed so immediate, and there was nothing to back it up. And the funny part is that CrowdStrike said it as well, But then when the when they're the, I don't know what title he has, a guy called Sean Henry, he was with CrowdStrike and he was in charge of that, you know, looking at the DNC. And he was called before Congress in 2017 to kind of talk about what happened there. And under oath, he was not willing to say that it was Russia. So there's press releases from CrowdStrike. There's newspaper articles citing CrowdStrike. There's, you can find tons and tons of that stuff that all say CrowdStrike says Russia did it. But the one time a CrowdStrike employee was under oath, he said, I don't know.
Yeah, I can't say that under oath. Interesting. CrowdStrike, of course, became infamous not that long ago with the supply chain hack that basically exposed half the enterprise software environments in the world. But yeah, did they blame that one on the Russians too? I can't remember, actually.
Probably. I don't know about the inner workings of CrowdStrike or whatever, but, you know, as a kind of an outsider to this whole IT world, it just, everything I've learned about these people strikes me as very dodgy. And, you know, let me give you another example here. When, so they put out all these things that, you know, it was Russia. And then when push came to shove, they couldn't say that it was Russia. But when you go and kind of analyze their press releases, it's circular, but it's circular in a way that they would have known it's circular. Some might call it a fraud. Mm-hmm. So what they say is our initial analysis that it was Russia was backed up by the Senate Intelligence Committee, or, you know, they cite, or the Office of Director of National Intelligence, they cite some government entities. Then you go and look at what the government entities said, the ones they cite. Well, they cite CrowdStrike. So you see, it's entirely circular, where CrowdStrike relies on them backing them up, and it actually it's vice versa. So that, you know, what serious company does that? I don't know. I mean, it just, again, I don't know that much about CrowdStrike and its inner workings, but I just find that very, very odd. It's just entirely unserious. And then, of course, they've got their CEO, Alperovich, who I just, at some point, this is years ago, I noticed he blocked me on Twitter. I'm like, who am I? I've never interacted with the guy. I'm just some guy who sometimes posts some stuff about Russiagate. This is many, many years ago. And then again, I'm thinking, what is this guy, the CEO, doing just blocking random Twitter users? It just, again, every single time I come across this company, as you say, you know, you had the recent meltdown with the airlines and so on. It just strikes me as something is very, very, you know, amiss with those people.
Interesting. Alpha Bank, I mean, kind of in my wheelhouse, right? So again, that didn't involve CrowdStrike, but it involved more tech people, some of which are known, like I know some of the people, I know some of the names involved here. So this was kind of a little crazy. Let's talk about the Alpha Bank Trump connection.
Very much so. So Alpha Bank is part of the this whole Swift boat hoax. Steele dossier was one. And the other part of it was the Alpha Bank hoax. So Steele dossier, again, we already talked about that. You've got this British former intelligence official, and he just writes reports exactly to the specifications of the Clinton campaign. And then those reports are fed to the media, and then you kind of build up this whole Trump-Russia thing. So the Alpha Bank thing was much more technical and much more detailed. The Alpha Bank hoax basically tried to create a linkage between Trump and the Kremlin, and not just a linkage because Steele said so in his reports, but an actual linkage that you can trace through the data. So what they said is that Trump has been communicating with Putin, and they've been using the servers of Alpha Bank. And Alpha Bank, spelled with an F, is a bank in Russia. Now, the whole thing was a complete hoax, as I'm sure you could explain a million times better than I could, just in terms of the technical kind of underpinnings of that. They still got the media to report on it, and the whole thing, I don't think it lived quite the life as the Steele dossier did until that was completely debunked. I think people were more skeptical kind of from the get-go, but still, it is, there's quite a lot of Alpha Bank stuff out there based on a transparent hoax of just, you know. So in the book, I talk a bit about how we know it's a hoax. And again, I cannot explain to you the technical side of it, but what I can tell you is that all the technical experts were saying it was a hoax right from the get-go, transparently so. This is simply, it means absolutely nothing. They just made stuff up.
Right. And then what it was supposed to prove was that there was actual direct communications between Trump and this bank. And that even when you looked at that, it's like, even if it were true, which it couldn't have been looking at the data, it wasn't Trump per se as much as some email marketing firm that was using a Trump domain that was probably contracted to like send like newsletters out on behalf of one of their brands.
Exactly. That's how completely, you know, just threadbare the whole thing was. In fact, it was so threadbare that the FBI, which we all know has been, and we haven't talked about them yet, I guess we'll talk about them here in a moment, but yeah. They fully endorsed this hoax. I mean, they were fully on board with it. But when the Clinton campaign, through one of its lawyers, showed up at the FBI in September of 2016 and gave them a USB stick and said, oh, here's very important information about Trump talking to Putin through the Russian Alpha Bank. That part of the hoax, that data that you just talked about, where it was literally just a marketing company, and even that is, you know, is not clear. The FBI technician whom this was given to on that very day, immediately, as in we're talking within minutes, identified the whole thing as a hoax and started joking about what a horrible and transparent hoax it was on FBI text messages with his colleagues. Now, we weren't told any of this. This came out many, many years later, and I talk about this in the book, where there was a court case, and eventually those text messages came out, and they proved beyond any doubt whatsoever that the FBI knew within minutes that the whole thing was a hoax.
Yeah, and without getting too into the weeds on it, I'm a DNS guy, I have to comment. It was like some of the DNS logs, which were preferred as evidence, were just actually like a DNS server can't produce this output because the logs are wrong, which sort of led to this almost a smoking gun that like it was just completely generated data that didn't even conform to the specification of how DNS works. So it's like you can't, a DNS server would never be able to output a log with this content in it, because like there was, I can't remember what the exact, well, it was like either the query types were wrong, or the address octets were just like non-existent addresses or something. It was just like, yeah, this can't happen. But let's talk about the FBI. And this brings us, I guess, to Crossfire.
Exactly. So the Clinton campaign was kind of ramping up pressure on this whole Trump-Russia narrative that they had been building up. So they were pushing the Steele dossier and parts of it into the media. Then you, of course, had the WikiLeaks that we already talked about that was blamed on Trump-Russia collusion. And all this culminated on July 31st, 2016, when the FBI felt the need to start looking into this themselves. So that's how they came on board. Now, there's some evidence that they actually started looking earlier, and July 31st, 2016 was just sort of the official launch of the Crossfire Hurricane investigation, which I'm sure is the case, and this is what happened. So and then they immediately went all in, you know. So they immediately started investigating four Trump associates. They started spying on a number of them through various means. So most people would have heard of this FISA warrant, where you go to a court, a secret court, and secretly get a warrant to spy on someone, and you get their emails, and you search their home, and you do all that kind of stuff. And that happened. But they only did that to one guy that we know of, a guy called Carter Page. He was a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign. But they spied on others as well, for instance, using confidential human sources. So there was two people that they sent their confidential human sources to befriend and pretend they're, you know, they're friends and just want to chat about stuff. There was one guy, George Papadopoulos. They sent they found an old school or college mate of his from years and years earlier, paid him money to go and meet George Papadopoulos and just start talking. And, you know, everything's recorded, and try and get him to talk about Russia, and try and get him to say incriminating stuff, and try and get him to talk about what's going on in the campaign, internal campaign strategies, and on and on and on. And I mean, I read the transcript. It's like hundreds and hundreds of pages. And these two guys had a great time. They went to the casino, and they just spent a whole a day or two together. And of course, nothing incriminating was said whatsoever, despite this source trying to get it there. And there's one that hasn't been talked about at all. I talk about it in a book, which is Sam Clovis. He was the foreign policy coordinator for the Trump campaign. He was a very high-ranking official in the campaign. So they sent another confidential human source to try and squeeze something out of that guy, or try and trap him, or in some way trip him up. That's hardly even known. So they tried all these different schemes. I don't think so much to try and find out if there's a there. I mean, maybe there was some aspect of that. Maybe we'll get lucky and there is something there. But I think they pretty much knew from the start that there is no there. And most of these schemes were basically entrapment schemes.
That was going to be my next question. It's like, did they start their investigation with like, hey, we're hearing these rumors that a candidate for president could be involved, and we have to, our job is to investigate this to see if there's any there? Or at some point, was it like co-opted or hijacked, and some prominent, you know, or names that became prominent associated with the FBI came out of that? And then actually the Crossfire label, where did that come from?
Yeah, the Crossfire label came from James Comey himself, because he was into, is it Rolling Stones or something like that, where he, you know, chose those names where he played these word games, you know, the typical Comey. But, you know, that's a really good question. And I think the answer is kind of a bit of a mixed bag. So I don't think the FBI's role was entirely completely in tandem with the Clinton campaign from day one, where they were just on the same page right from the start, February 2016. You know, we're going to trip up Trump. We're going to get Trump. Yes, they also wanted to get Trump, but I think there are some indications, not many, but a few to be fair, that early on they thought maybe there is something we need to look at. But the point is that they would have figured out, and they did figure out, like we already talked about the Alpha thing, they figured that out within minutes, that it's a hoax. And the hoax came from the Clinton campaign.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of evidence to show that even if, again, we're trying to be generous here, right? Even if some people in the FBI thought, okay, this is something we ought to look at, they would have figured out, and they did figure out very, very quickly, that in fact, this is a hoax that was orchestrated by the Clinton campaign. And we actually have it in writing. James Comey, the director of the FBI, was told on July 28th, 2016, so that is before the official opening of the Crossfire Hurricane investigation, that Hillary Clinton had a plan to falsely tie Trump to Russia. And he was told
falsely,
this by the CIA.
Is the word falsely in there? Or
yeah, it was, yeah.
Wow.
She had a plan to vilify Trump by falsely, or don't quote me, maybe not the word falsely, but it was what was in there for sure, is that this was a fraudulent scheme that was cooked up by the Clinton campaign. So he knew that. He knew that right from the get-go. And he got that information from the CIA. Now, why would the CIA pass it to him? I think CYA is probably the most appropriate way of explaining this. We don't know what goes inside people's heads, but it was a guy called John Brennan, who was CIA director at the time. He gave it to Comey. He also gave it to President Obama. Again, why would he do that? I can only think that he did so for CYA, because he didn't want to later be blamed for not passing on the information. But to be honest, it didn't really matter. Obama, Brennan himself, Comey, everyone was like, whatever, who cares? We're just going to forge on here with our kind of get Trump campaign. So coming back to, you know, your question, just to kind of sum up here, I think, again, if we're generous, there are some indications that at least some people within the FBI maybe thought there might be something to it. But even if that was the case, all of that was cast aside very, very quickly. And then it just became get Trump, ignore the truth, ignore the facts, just get Trump.
Is this, what was the guy's name? He was in front of, he got called up to testify, StarTalk or StarTalk, maybe I'm mixed up with something else. You know, he was an FBI guy. He had the famous, almost demonic picture.
Oh, yes, Strzok.
Yeah.
He has, he's got that, I think it's Strzok. That's his name. Yeah, Peter Strzok.
He was part of this, right?
He was a central part of it.
He was up to his eyeballs in it. Okay.
He was, and you know, you're absolutely right, focusing on him, because in many ways he kind of embodies this, what I was just talking about, the fact that something which might have been innocent at the start very quickly became something very, very nefarious. He got a tip, Strzok did, in July. But yeah, first of all, they get tips all the time. So yeah, nothing huge, but he seized on that tip. That tip came from an Australian diplomat, and one of, called Alexander Downer. Now, Alexander Downer had met casually a Trump campaign aide called George Papadopoulos. And George Papadopoulos told Alexander Downer something which had been aired on Fox News the night before the two men met. So I don't know for a fact that that is where George Papadopoulos got it from, but it's a pretty solid guess that that is where he got it from. And what it was that Russia had Hillary Clinton's emails. Now, remember back then, everyone was talking about her missing 30,000 emails. So Hillary Clinton had this private server in her bathroom, which she used for her State Department business in order to avoid freedom of information laws. And when it came time to, that was uncovered in 2015, and it came time to hand over all these government emails, which happened to be on her private server, she claimed that they were all gone, deleted, oopsie, and they weren't important anyway. They were just about Chelsea's wedding, her daughter's wedding, and about her yoga classes. That's what she claimed, 30,000 emails. So remember back then, 2015, 16, everyone was like, oh, what happened to those emails? So, yet a Fox News show on May 9th, 2016, where the guest says, well, I've just confirmed that Russia has them, and now we're all going to wonder what Russia will do with those emails. And Papadopoulos, one day afterwards, on May 10th, told this Australian diplomat a version of that story. The Australian diplomat didn't think much of it, but he obviously didn't watch Fox News because he didn't make the connection.
Yeah.
And kind of later in July, when the Clinton campaign was whipping up this Trump-Russia stuff, he was like, oh, maybe I'll just tell my American counterpart, because, you know, we're friends here. He was the Australian ambassador in London, and they're all friends with the other ambassadors. So he told the American ambassador in London, hey, by the way, I just wanted to let you know there was this guy, Papadopoulos, and he talked about Russia having Clinton's emails. Again, the information was public. It was on Fox News. It was on Fox News the day before Papadopoulos said it. So it was a complete nothing burger. Anyway, Strzok immediately grabbed that bit of information and then blew it up into this huge thing where he basically then claimed that this proves that the Trump campaign was coordinating with Russia to release Hillary Clinton's emails. I mean, none of it was true, and there was no evidence for any of it. But again, you know, coming back to my point here, my main point, yes, if you hear that kind of story, you might for a moment want to investigate, or for a moment think, well, what if Papadopoulos did know? And then you look into it, you spend 5, 10, 20 minutes looking into the details. What did the Australian guy say? When did he say it? When did Papadopoulos say it? Oh, this is just public information. Papadopoulos was just saying what everyone was saying. Okay, no big deal. And you move on. But of course, he didn't move on.
And who was Papadopoulos again? He was a Trump campaign person.
Advisor. Yeah, right. He was a Trump campaign advisor, foreign policy, just like Carter Page. He played a minor role. I mean, there's nothing huge that he did. But because he had that association, you know, that was easy for the FBI to kind of seize on that and say, ah, he, you know, he's the coordinator. He's the one who's passing on stuff from Russia or whatever. It totally made up. None of it was true. No evidence for it of any kind. But they ran with it regardless.
So here's a pattern that I see. Okay. So you're telling me Brennan passes on to Comey the fact that the Hillary Clinton campaign is manufacturing a smear campaign against Trump.
Correct.
And Hillary Clinton is running a server in her bathroom to circumvent FOIA requirements.
Correct.
And both of those incidents turn into an investigation against Trump.
Exactly. When it should have been
neither of them turn into investigations against Hillary Clinton.
Exactly.
And then later, of course, totally a tangent, but then, you know, Trump gets Mar-a-Lago raided for sort of what would have been a sort of light Reader's Digest light version of what Clinton did do, right? And exactly. What Biden ended up doing. It seems a little lopsided. Okay. So now let's sort of move forward a bit to, like, this is all kind of fizzled out until, I guess, the Durham inquiry.
Right.
Right. So and then take us through that, because he gets appointed by Barr, but then the Trump administration comes to an end, and then this continues on under the Biden administration. So let's start there.
Right, exactly. So at some point, the things that we just talked about became kind of public, mainly through those random internet users or random Twitter users that I keep talking about. Uncovering
the fact that this was all jerry-rigged and souped up and manufactured, like, that kind of became part of the public, like, yeah, everybody knows this is BS, except for, like, people with purple hair and pronouns in their Twitter bios.
Exactly right. But again, I want to emphasize that this is a really important part of the story, in my view, that all of this was, or most of it was, uncovered literally by just some random people online.
Yeah.
Okay. So those people uncovered it. And as you say, that from that kind of this bigger picture emerged that the whole thing was a giant hoax. So then Barr, to his credit, thought, okay, I should appoint someone as special counsel. At first, he was not special counsel, was just a U.S. attorney looking into it. And later on, he was made a special counsel, this guy, John Durham.
What's the difference? What's the difference between, like, hey, look into this, and you're a special counsel now?
No, we're going to spend a long time talking about this.
Okay, we don't have to go down a rabbit hole,
let's, I guess. I'm just trying to think of how to make this as short as possible.
Bigger budget? More.
No, not necessarily. In fact, the special counsel budget can be more constrained, which is what happened in John Durham's case. More independence, supposedly.
Okay.
Actually, it's not much of a difference. It's just, I guess it looks more authoritative being special counsel, and supposedly you have more independence, but you don't really have that. This is why it would be a very long discussion if we talked about it. And the short reason for that is because the statute relating to special counsel expired. So that's not even an official position within the U.S. government, and it no longer exists.
Okay.
And there's some argument now as to whether Jack Smith, the guy coming after Trump, has even been lawfully appointed. And we already had a federal judge saying, no, he was not lawfully appointed because this position does not exist within the federal government hierarchy. And that's correct. It does not exist. So, anyway, that's kind of for another day. It's a very interesting topic in and of itself, but, whether we call him U.S. attorney and special counsel doesn't really matter. This guy, John Durham, he was tasked with looking at, this whole thing is a hoax. So where did the hoax come from? And how did it start? And who perpetuated it? And were any crimes committed in perpetuating this hoax? Because, of course, a political smear isn't necessarily a crime, but it can become a crime. Like, for instance, when the Clinton campaign took that USB drive with the fake data, the Alpha Bank stuff, to the FBI, well, that's a crime because that counts as lying to the FBI. And there's various other things we can talk about, which are in the book as well, as to the distinction there. So Durham was tasked with that. And I have a feeling he relied a lot on what, again, those random internet and Twitter users were doing. Because you could see this sort of the parallels between what he was doing, and it was always like a couple of months after whatever we were doing online. So, for instance, we found this guy Danchenko. I'd mentioned him at the outset. So he was kind of Steele's patsy. So when Steele got called out on his entire dossier being a fraud, he basically blamed this guy, Igor Danchenko, this Russian guy. Oh, well, this Russian guy told me. And we eventually found this guy. Again, the whole story is in the book as to how we did that. We found his name. And then it turns out that Steele Super Source, the one who allegedly had Putin's ear and so on, well, he was a total nobody. He worked at a think tank in Washington, D.C. He wasn't even in Russia, you know. So that whole thing turned out to be a hoax. Well, guess what? A few months after we kind of discovered all of that, Durham was on that case. So, you know, you can see this pattern over and over. I don't know in how much he relied on what anonymous people on Twitter were doing, but I think there was certainly a part of it that did rely on that. Now, something, I think he was doing well with that. That was going quite well. And then something happened, and it preceded Biden, to be fair. And we still don't know what that was. But Durham had his wings clipped. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, he was no longer looking at FBI malfeasance. And all of a sudden, he wasn't really looking at the origin of the whole Russiagate hoax. All of a sudden, everything kind of petered out. And again, this preceded Biden. We can't blame Biden for that. Okay. Now, I know he had a very small office. He had a very small budget. There was, you know, lots of constraints, but there is still a story there that we don't know what that story is. It might have something to do with Barr. Maybe it was Barr who clipped his wings. I don't know. Barr turned sour on Trump in the final kind of months of 2020. We do know that. So
remember that. Yeah.
There is a story there. It's a known unknown, as Donald Rumsfeld would have said. We're going to have to wait. One day, I'm sure we'll find out.
And there was a name that I remember, one name coming out during the Durham inquiry a lot, Sussman.
Yeah. Sussman was the Clinton campaign lawyer who actually brought the USB drive to the FBI.
Okay. And so here we are now. Okay, we know the outcomes of the Durham inquiry. We've got an election, like, I don't know, by the time this airs, 30 days away, right? How is this relevant now? Or I guess it could be such a wild card question because a lot depends on, will Trump win the election? Does any of this come back to haunt? Does all of this just become historical record? Is this still playing out now? Do you know Steele has a new book out, right?
He does. all I can say about that is the true story, all footnoted and all with all the original sources, primary source documents, is in my book. So if you want to know what actually happened, that's in my book. If you, I haven't read Steele's book. I read, some people who have read it told me what they thought of it. And it wasn't very good. And basically he's just kind of trying to justify what he did. But it's what he did is unjustifiable because he just made up stories, made them up from whole cloth. There's nothing to it whatsoever.
There's another one this morning. Yeah. Like I saw one, the story, like just before I came on today, I was like, there's an article in the Guardian saying Steele says that Trump illegally stored UK naval secrets after he left office. And I'm like, this sounds exactly the same.
Exactly. The guy just makes stuff up. It's as simple as that. And I think before I move on to the other part of your question, which I think is very fascinating, you know, where does this all lead us? One final word on Steele here. I don't think it's fully appreciated that not one thing in his dossier turned out to be true. Nothing whatsoever. Nothing was ever corroborated. Nothing whatsoever. Of course, there will be a city or a date or whatever, but you can look those up on a calendar or, you know, on Google. So, but other, like Carter Page, the Trump campaign aide, that he exists, or what job he had, that he once worked for Merrill Lynch. He once had an assignment in Moscow. Those are facts. You can look those facts up. But anything beyond that, anything about what Carter Page did or what any of these other characters did, is all made up. And this is such an important thing to note about the entire dossier. It's not one of these, oh, well, he got some things right, he got some things wrong. No, he got absolutely everything wrong because it was all made up. Now, in terms of where does this lead us, I think that's a hugely important question. Of course, we can't predict, you know, is Kamala going to win? Is Trump going to win? what's going to happen to Russiagate if Trump wins? Is he going to try and, you know, go and really try and find the people and hold them accountable who did this to him? I don't know. Obviously, if Kamala wins, that's not going to happen. If he wins, I don't even think it's going to happen if he wins. I think he'll have many other things to worry about. I hope he does, but who knows? I hope there's going to be more in terms of declassification. There's still a lot of documents that are missing. There's still a lot of stuff we don't know, such as, for instance, we already mentioned Durham. Why were his wings clipped? We don't know that. But what we can say for certain is that the entire kind of US-Russia relationship was toxified. It was poisoned mm-hmm. by this. Diplomacy was criminalized. This hoax criminalized diplomacy. Trump could have done something to at least make relations better with Russia, but he wasn't allowed to. Trump could have perhaps prevented the Ukraine war. Again, he wasn't allowed to. And that cannot be turned, that clock cannot just be turned back. So let's say Trump wins and suddenly Russia is all good. Everyone accepts that Russia is great and so on. That's not going to happen. If Trump wins and he tries to do something positive with Russia, we're going to have all the same crap again about, just this week we had crap again about, oh, Trump sent Putin some COVID tests. Therefore, Trump is the worst person ever. When anyone who has ever worked in the real world, especially in marketing, knows that that is a, if in fact that happened, is a brilliant move. It's a tiny little thing. You send him a box of COVID tests. It means nothing, but it does mean something on the interpersonal level. It's one of those things where you may reap huge rewards in future. It's just extremely stupid how the media has been treating that. But unfortunately, even if Trump wins, that's what we're going to get if he tries to do anything in terms of fixing the Ukraine situation, fixing the relations with Russia and so on. We're just going to be kind of stuck in the hamster wheel where we're just going to have to relive all this crap. And, you know, I hope this book, my book, makes this at least a small contribution to a few more people finding out what really happened. And that was all made up. That was just nothing to it. Nothing whatsoever.
Probably a great place to leave it. Hans Mahnke, the book is Swift Boating America. The foreword is by our mutual friend, Aram Fuchs, and it should be in bookstores by the time you see this episode. I'll drop the links in the show notes. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.